Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. To part one of the Lapper podcast. Joining me in studio is the perennial Maria. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
That's good. So we have been absent for a few weeks, but our listenership has remained consistent, if not my pronunciation. But we should explain our absence, really. We've been absent for the last few weeks because, well, we've only gone and written a bleeding book, haven't we?
Yes, we have.
So it's basically, well, it's written in Spanish and it's going to be sold in Spain and also in Mexico and potentially in Chile, Argentina, and other places like that. And like that, I mean, I guess Latin America.
As in other countries.
And then after Christmas, it's going to be in the English speaking market. So it's fake news, rumors that have changed the world. But in Spanish, of course, Maria, It is.
Can we say that?
Yeah, of course we can, yeah. Okay. Well, what's it in Spanish?
Oh, in Spanish. Bulos que cambiaron el curso de la historia.
Exactly. So, rumors that have changed the course of history. We've written it over the last period of time, anyway. And we have... it's been a massive effort. We've been researching a lot of it. We've done stories from ancient Roman times. modern Roman times. Wow, that modern political far-right alliance in Italy is something, right? No, we've been talking about Donald Trump. That those are the kind of more modern chapters, anti-vaxxers, and also Brexit is the last chapter of the book, or is it the anti-vaxxers?
Anti-vaxxers.
Yeah, so there's 30 stories, 30 rumors. Yeah, so we talk about everything, Rasputin, Marie Antoinette, the stab in the back theory of the First World War. We speak about the German corpse factory rumors. Well, there's a few stories from World War II, to be fair. We also talk about, well, some of your stories, Ceausescu in Romania. And you talk about Roswell also. So, yeah, it kind of goes everywhere, no? In a tangible...
Space and time.
Yeah, between space and time, but with a tangible link between all of them. And in part two, I guess we'll talk about more of that process of writing that book and why we felt this story was important to be told. But there's another story that you've been telling, or you will be telling... Krishna. Is this the Hare Krishna Krishna or
no? It's not. Well, no, it's not the Hare Krishna Krishna.
Okay. And so, well, before we get into that, I have to say you did drag me to an old folks' residence for a Bollywood show, and it was exciting.
Rewriting stuff.
Well, no, because there's one woman getting very cantankerous because someone stole her seat, but also I never knew there was so much beef between one group of retired flamenco dancers and one group of retired Bollywood dancers. It was almost like East Coast, West Coast, hip-hop,
yeah,
aggro, and you're the mediator in all of that. And you're there in the front row, kind of like instructing them how to do the different moves as well.
Yeah,
were
just a reminder.
Were you proud of their performance?
Yeah, I was. They did really well, and then the people that saw them were very happy, so that's good.
That's true. And you were brought on stage at some point as well?
Well, just to, like, weigh you at the end.
Exactly. And also, you're also the protagonist of this new dance.
Well, the protagonist, you mean I'm in it.
Yeah, you're in it. It's really interesting. You were kind of... telling me about this Krishna dancing thing. So it's basically it's a traditional song that's been sung by this famous Indian group and became a kind of sensation, number one hit, top of the pops.
That's the one about the temple.
About the temple, okay.
The temple. The one about Krishna is just a traditional folklore song. Okay. Both of them are folklore, but the one about the temple has been released as a pop song.
Okay.
More or less.
Well, that's really cool because I don't think there's any examples of Well, maybe going back to the 90s, something like Darragh Dún. Well, that's always popular, but like it's something that's just always there rather than being something that, you know, is kind of an original piece of work or like a modern interpretation of something traditional, you know? I mean, I'm thinking of...
Well, as in, he drinks a vodka drink, he drinks... That song has a...
Oh, that was referenced in The Guardian today, actually, about Jeremy Corbyn. Chumba Wamba or something.
Chumba Wamba.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You knock me down, I get back up again.
That's it.
Oh, daddy boy.
Exactly, and then he says, so
okay,
there
okay.
you go, there you go. That's my contribution.
Alright then, that's... I wasn't thinking of that as such, but Whiskey in a Jar would be another alcoholic-based song that was a traditional song sung by Thin Lizzy. And they didn't want to sing it, but it actually became their breakout hit because they were a group that weren't really popular. And then they became this kind of Irish heavy metal group with some kind of rock influences led by the very charismatic and very cool Phil Lynott, whose statue you can find in Dublin at the moment. But anyway, that's by the by. So, yeah. It's a new phrase I'm trying out. I think I'll drop it. But so this Christian thing is like, so if it's not the Hare Krishna that we know, what's the significance of this character in Indian culture?
Well, Krishna is one of the most important gods in Hinduism.
Okay, yeah.
So, well, yeah, and basically it tells the story of like when he was little, the things that he gets up to, because he's like very like naughty, mischievous a bit.
That reminds me, because you invented a new movement where you're wagging your finger at Krishna.
Yeah, Krishna himself. Yeah, because in part of the song, you perform, it's kind of like a kind of theater where you perform different characters, and one of the characters is Krishna's mother.
Okay.
And obviously Krishna, like, he asks for butter, because that's what he asks for when he's little, for some reason.
Okay.
He wants butter, and then he cries when you don't give him butter, so then the mother, like, tells him, basically, I'm gonna smack you if you keep crying.
Okay, and then you're supposed to be kind of like waving your finger and then doing a movement with it, but you started wagging it, and you improvise this movement like a...
Yeah, it just came on naturally, you know, because I'm such a grumpy...
Guts.
Old woman.
Okay, well, fair enough. Well, thank you for explaining.
You're welcome.
All about Krishna. I'm not sure if I understand it any better, but...
No, for sure.
It's been interesting. We'll talk about that book we just bloody went and wrote in part two after this musical interlude. Welcome to part two, and Mary, where did you get the idea for this book?
Well, one night we were having a conversation in a bar. No.
Okay, well, it doesn't really matter where we got the idea from.
Exactly.
But it's very much a trending topic, no?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And you know, before we kind of get into the book, it's just incredible because... this book is essentially a history of fake news. So we do the historical sweep of fake news, as we mentioned in the first part of the show. But it's also very current in our world. And every week, something comes out that really proves that. You know, I mean, you had the Conservatives publishing this fake Labour manifesto website on the internet, of course. Also a fake... Fact Checker website was also identified during the week as well. Mm-hmm. And Sacha Baron Cohen, I sent you the link to the interview in The Guardian as well, kind of gave this speech where he talks about how Facebook, you know, are really helping the spread of fake news as well. It was very eloquent. So eloquent, in fact, you could almost, for your part, forgive Ali G, Borat, and Bruno. So if the book was released a little bit later, we could put even more into it, because it's something that is reaching like this critical mass, but it's not running out of steam. That's a mixed metaphor, but at any time, and it doesn't seem like it's going to be going anywhere for the time being. So it's kind of fascinating to chart this evolution, and also we can talk about the future of fake news, kind of towards the end of the part, you know. So I think to kind of frame the book, because we do talk in the conclusion of the book about people who are involved in identifying fake news, in correcting it, in debunking it, in busting the myths that it's generated by fake news. And these are the kind of heroes on the front line safeguarding the sanctity of what we know to be true, if you indulge my flights of verbal fancy there. But in our book, you know, we're not, we don't dedicate our daily professional life to that. But I think in the book, what we do focus on is the victims of fake news, and that's something that's kind of apparent through each chapter. I think so. Do you think that would be the main focus of our story, or how would you kind of frame it?
Yeah, I think there are, well, one element is to talk about how through these different stories you can see how manipulation has been, you know, a way of like keeping power and so on, which of course we know, but I think, I don't know, it's something that has been taken for granted, but you're right that from the side of like people that were affected by it, I think that's been greatly forgotten. And I think another important thing is how throughout you can see how it's more or less the same social groups that get targeted.
I mean, Jewish people,
for example,
foreigners,
mm-hmm.
For example, and
poor
people,
mm.
and women. As well,
mm-hmm.
In terms of Marie Antoinette, the Jack the Ripper victims, the women who were accused of witchcraft in Salem. So these are, of course, chapters in the book as well. And so, yeah, I mean, othering. I mean, we have a vocabulary now in the modern world that refers to episodes that appear in the book. And very much othering is something that we understand as creating this kind of specter of another, which refers usually to foreigners or immigrants or something like that, and that's something that's a thread throughout the story as well. In the case of Rasputin, he was feared because people assumed he was an agent for the Germans during the First World War. Marie Antoinette was the Austrian, and Austria was a longtime enemy of France, and her marriage to the king was a way to forge a kind of peace between France and Austria. But she was always known as the Austrian. Other nicknames she had as well, of course, Madame Deficit, and this kind of tallies with her image as this kind of spendthrift party girl. You know, actually, to focus on Marie Antoinette for a second, what was interesting about her story is that when you kind of dig deep into it, you can kind of see that she was a modern girl in a sense. She was quite young when she got married. She liked to have a good time in the way young people today like to have a good time. And, you know, at this time, you know, you also had kind of French ideas, Rousseau as well. This is something, you know, this kind of modern conception of the self, which, you know, if you're the French queen, you couldn't be just this individual. You're part of this institution. And she found, quite justifiably, the bureaucratic rigors of courts stifling, and she escaped every time she got a chance to. And that, you know, you can sympathize with that, because even when she was getting dressed in the morning, she had to have, like, ladies-in-waiting kind of watching her as this part of ritual. And if somebody came in who is higher ranked than the people already in the room, the whole dressing procedure would have to start again, essentially. And also, she didn't reward people for their social rank. She just hung around with people that she actually liked, you know, which was create a lot of jealousy at court and, create a lot of divisions. But essentially, she just seems like a lost, out of time, out of step woman who didn't really do a lot wrong. And by all accounts, was a decent enough mother as well, you know. So she was just, because like in her court trial she was also accused of all these terrible things against her children as well. So and then when we see, you mentioned poverty, the Salem witch trials, you had poor women, infertile women, women considered to be unattractive by the standards of the puritanical society, or women that were kind of independent, again, who didn't fit into puritanical society, were targeted as witches. Because, you know, you can see both sides of the coin. I know I'm jumping from one event to another, but, you know, these Puritans really believed that anything out of the ordinary was the devil's work. So you can kind of see how this fantastical notion could gain traction, but also how these poor victims were people who didn't have much of a stake in society and didn't really do too much wrong, but some of them paid with their lives, either you know, being executed or in the terrible conditions of the prison as well. And in the case of Jack the Ripper victims, you know, we had this popular conception that these women were prostitutes. Not all of them were prostitutes, based on a fantastic book by Hattie Rubenthal, which we mentioned in a previous podcast as well. And we can say, because of the Victorian mindset, their poverty, if you're homeless or seen as poor, in the Victorian mind, you're already seen as some kind of reprobate. You deserve to be poor because you didn't work for your money. And also, if you're a woman, you're automatically seen as a prostitute as well. And how it was reported, how the victims were treated, it was like almost lurid, it was sexual, it was, you know, disregarding the kind of horrific details of the murders. And their names have been lost more or less in the story, because we just focus on Jack the Ripper and the intrigue of who he was, even though essentially, even though we don't have a name for him, he was a killer and an animal, a monster, you know. So you can kind of see, like, a lot of chapters, I think you'll agree with this as well, that when we were you know, sometimes, you know, you go into a story and you have a great familiarity with it, or in other stories you think you do, other stories you're starting from almost zero before you start researching it, and you're quite surprised about the things that come out, and you have a lot of sympathy for certain characters, or you kind of see it in a new way. And also you can kind of see how society in general is kind of evolving as well, because even though Hattie Rubenthal's book has been met with disdain by a lot of ripperologists, I think a lot of people like her treatment of these victims. And in Paris, I think at the moment, or maybe in a new year, in January, there's an exhibition about her fashion, about Marie Antoinette, I mean, and kind of like celebrating who she was as this kind of glamorous fashion icon as well, which is what she was when she was alive. So we're kind of slowly seeing as well these victims being rehabilitated in the eyes of society and kind of coming back to life, in a sense, you know. But so that's kind of like my perspective of the book, but I'm sure you can kind of pick up these threads, or you can give me your opinions as well about your chapters or anything that you want.
No, I think the example that you put, because people could say, well, yeah, but Marie Antoinette, well, they were still like upper class or whatever, but I think the thing that we focus on, which is quite interesting, is this concept that you were saying of like othering, of like how foreigners and, you know, people are automatically suspicious of them. And that's like a constant thing throughout history. So for example, in other stories, the poor people side of things plays a very important part. But obviously it wasn't the case with her, but the fact that she was a foreigner was still like important enough, for example. So I think what I like the most about doing the research is that every story is interesting, but what's more striking is that you don't quite realize how many like common themes there are throughout history until you start researching. And then in the end, it's all about those groups that are targeted, and it's the same nowadays. So
yes, because something we said a lot to each other was, maybe history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme, and nothing really is new, because we've seen it all before. Anything you want to say about Brexit or Trump or any of these kind of shenanigans, they have their historical parallel. No matter if you're looking in the ancient times with the Romans, or if you're looking at the Middle Ages, or the relatively kind of modern era of the French Revolution, going on towards the First World War and the Second World War and beyond that as well. So So yeah, so you can kind of get a sense of how these things remain constant. And
I think the only difference nowadays was the fact that it was a lot more amplified. So obviously, like, the channels that we have nowadays mean that it can be done in a much bigger scale, but it's essentially the same thing.
I mean, yes and no. I mean, we have this ding dong.
About globalization.
Globalization. Because I'm a big believer that globalization has been... Okay, obviously, it's a global village now with Facebook and WhatsApp and technology, but I think the world has always been this kind of integrated and globalized.
Okay, so in terms of speed, at least. It might not be in terms of, like, reaching out, because it was probably the same also in the past in different scales, but it just can be done a lot faster.
Well, that's undeniable, I should say.
Okay.
For you, does any standard or story or chapter stand out in terms of its impact on you, or what you think it's important, its importance is for the readers?
Well, I think the one about the Timișoara massacre, which is the one that you mentioned about Ceaușescu.
Yeah.
It posed a lot of, like, moral issues in a way, because this is something that was staged as a massacre that hadn't happened. But it was kind of like what triggered people internationally paying attention. So we were actually talking about that earlier with, like, regards to this other podcast that we listened to.
About Gabon.
Because in the end, it's like, does the end justify the means, you know? Can fake news be good in any context when you're using it to try and fight, like, evil? And I think what happened with the massacre was that. It was like, okay, it didn't happen. That one that was portrayed was a fake, but it probably or most likely did happen in all the moments of the same regime. So I still don't think it's, like, justified, of course, but it opens sort of like this debate about, you know, some people think, well, if it's for a good cause, then it's okay to lie.
Yeah.
But ultimately, my problem is what we were mentioning earlier. I think that if the moment that you come into it with lies, then, well, you kind of, like, lose legitimacy.
And what you're fighting against is already so extreme. I mean, Ceaușescu's regime, that you don't really need to have fake news for your cause, because the reality is already so stark and unsettling. And
yeah, so I think that's what baffles you when you're, like, researching this sort of thing, and you think, you know, some of the things are, like, dramatic enough, and so, like, yeah, they're being replaced by something that didn't happen but could have happened. So it's kind of like this weird psychological thing of why people do this and kind of like the extent that people are willing to get to.
Well, this, you mentioned the psychology. I think that does appear. We actually mention it specifically in different chapters. I mean, if you look at Salem, if babies died, why did they blame the neighbor? You know, why did they accuse her of being a witch? Because emotionally, you need some kind of valve, a release valve, to say, well, this is how I rationalize this terrible event.
Hmm.
And I think that's what it is. I mean, if you're in Michigan and there's no car industry, well, whose fault is it? It's either the Democrats or it's immigrants or something like that. So, I mean, there's always this kind of, like, psychological components of either lying to yourself or lying to other people, or blaming others to kind of, like, either rationalize this chaotic and unsettling world. And it's always been chaotic and unknowable and full of surprises and unstable, and you know, you could lose things in a heartbeat, basically. You know, a crop could fail, or your child could die, or something like that, you know. So I think that's kind of what is this kind of basic human need is also a factor in the fake news story.
I think as individuals, yes, but also I think as corporations, governments, like, kind of like the establishment, is a way of, like, not assuming responsibility.
Well, yeah, you do see that in the Rwanda chapter, which we can touch on in a second. But I think, like, even in our chapter about the stab in the back, because There are several factors that we discuss, how the German people at home during World War One were kind of kept in the dark about how the war was progressing. And also, they were lied to a little bit as well about, you know, victories that never were, and casualty rates kind of, you know, not really reported accurately either. And then that's why defeat came as such as a shock. But also they were fed in this idea of this kind of Prussian masculine German man, and then defeat didn't really tally with their perception of themselves. And of course that's where it comes into it again, this kind of idea of like, well, a German, this kind of masculine man, could never really be defeated unless he had been betrayed by somebody, and that could be foreigners, Jewish people, and things like that. But you mentioned international organizations or people trying to cover themselves. It's not my responsibility. This kind of idea that kind of crops up very starkly in the Rwanda chapter, because the United Nations were very, I guess, ineffectual in kind of dealing with this unfolding genocide. And we have to say as well, the reaction of the international community in general, is something that was very passive and also informed by these ingrained kind of Western Eurocentric kind of stereotypes. And what's also fascinating is to see this kind of battle, this blame game between United Nations, NGOs, and nobody really comes out of that with too much credit either, you know. We talk about El Dorado, the Spanish-Cuban War. We talk about the murder of John Calla, a guy whose murder, or well, his execution, he was accused of murdering his own son, exposed deep fault lines, religious intolerance in France, and got the attention of Voltaire, and basically he went on a 3-year crusade to clear this man's name, and has had ramifications for the modern world in terms of kind of conceptions of torture, waterboarding, and kind of extracting confessions and the right to a fair trial as well. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot in there, I think, in this book.
Buy the book.
Buy the book. So before we kind of wrap up this part, what we can say is, well, with a view to a future, it is quite depressing, the volume of fake news, how unrelenting it is. But I've seen, for example, that people in Eastern Europe have been exposed to fake news for a longer period of time. And allegedly, it's a lot easier for them to identify it, and it's harder to hoodwink them when it comes to fake news. So I do believe that we'll probably come to a point where it's the same for us, and fake news will lose its potency. But also because of the good work of people who are trying to safeguard the truth, you know, we have a fighting chance of having a future that... that isn't so muddied or obscured by fake news, because you know, there's a concept of bearing witness, which we have with NGOs. Sometimes NGOs can help people, but if they keep the name alive of people who've been tortured or murdered or imprisoned illegally, that in itself is a valuable act. And if you have people who can even just call out fake news, even if it doesn't have an immediate consequence, that's a new version of bearing witness as well. And I think we all are responsible for doing it. I don't know. And how do you see the future before we wrap this up as well?
No, I think we're talking the conclusion about how things are going, like with regards to deep fakes and these sort of new technologies. I don't know. I honestly don't know like what it would be like, because things are speeding up so much and there are more and more things showing. And I think in the end, it will come to a point where we talk about how there's no right or wrong anymore, and it's all about perception, and or that's what, you know, people want you to believe. But I think it will come a point where things will have to revert, and, you know, perception won't be like accepted as a universal truth anymore.
Yeah, I mean, we've definitely seen countless examples of politicians who lie and they don't get any blowback or pushback from that. But there has to be a tipping point. I mean, if we talk about the environment, they talk about tipping points, and it was in the newspapers today as well. But I mean, if you look at Boris Johnson, for example, who promised he wouldn't sell off the NHS to the Americans, and now there's evidence that that could be a possibility if he wins the election in December. But you know, people are suffering so much now. If you look at Britain, for example, there's things like life expectancy is lower in some parts of England than it is in Turkey. A lot of people are using food banks to survive, to get to the end of their month and things like this. So you know, people are you know, have suffered already because of politicians like Johnson or Trump, because of their circus of fake news and lies. But I assume or expect that there'll be a tipping point where people will suffer so much and will eventually come around to the idea that it's not this other that's causing their problems, it's the people that they've placed their faith in, you know. So I don't know how far they can push this, you know, to push this boat or push this agenda where they can just be expedient and just, you know, make it up as they go along. You know, there has to be a judgment day for them eventually, surely, logically, you know.
I don't know, I really like, I can't figure out, but it will come. Eventually we'll have this conversation in 20 years time.
For the fourth edition of the book. So, well, enjoy this musical interlude, and we'll be back momentarily with the inevitable third part. And you can find our book on Amazon, and if you happen to be in Mexico, in whatever are the main bookshops there, I guess. And if you happen to be in Spain, Casa
del Libro. Way of alienating the listeners and readers.
Well, in Spain as well, Casa del Libro, Fnac, El Corte Inglés, Natura, and also
Natura.
Not in Natura, no.
Not in Natura.
I thought it was in Natura.
That's another book.
Oh, okay. And in some independent bookshops, the Cervantes, is that what it's called, bookshop?
Cervantes y Compañía.
Cervantes y Compañía, perfect. Okay, so, you can find us, where can you find us?
I don't know where you can find us these days.
Well, we deleted Instagram.
Because now that we're becoming famous authors.
You know, we paint pictures with words, so we don't actually need pictures anymore. And on Twitter, elapra1, Facebook, elapramedia, and wherever you find your podcast, and also on Patreon if you feel that way inclined, in terms of giving us a little bit of your hard-earned money to keep our projects going. And that's it, more or less. So I bid you a good Krishna, and thank you so much for listening.
Happy Krishna,
and hopefully we'll be back in more of a regular swing of things. But I think now the book has been out of the way, and we can have more time to dedicate to this. Oh, and also our blog is irishsliceofmadrid.com. Link in the description. Good luck.
Bye.
The Alapra Podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.